Welcome to the Near Post Local, where too much football or futsal is never likely to be enough. I'm Peter Funnell. Tonight, we have the first of three interviews the Near Post Local has conducted with John Mitchell, the coach of the ANU Premier League. But look, before we go to the interview, we must cover off on some ACT football and futsal news and opinions. The Premier League futsal is underway. Can't give you the scores. Capital Football haven't put them up on the website since round one. The FFA's Youth Championship for under 15 and under 14 boys has concluded. It was run at Coffs Harbour. The under 14 boys results were these. First place, Victoria Metro. Second place, New South Wales Metro. And third place, Capital Football. Yep, that's us, Capital Football. Outstanding effort, gentlemen. That is a hotly contested age group. But the icing on the cake in the under 14 boys at this championship was the award of the Nike Golden Boot to none other than young Michael Tarazi, Capital Football player. What an outstanding effort. The under 15 boys did not fare as well. First place went to New South Wales Metro, second place to Northern New South Wales, and third place to Victoria Metro. Seventh place to Capital Football. Interesting rumour on the sideline at the Canberra United game. Several people told me that the Capital Football proposed under 17 and under 20 high performance squads would not be raised by Capital Football. Well, that would, of course, explain why the lists have not been published. All the other lists have been published. Well, this is very disappointing if it's true. Well, there may well be good reason for it, of course. We'll speak to Capital Football and see if we can find out for you. We have no A-League youth team, so we have nothing to aim up at. We need to get an A-League youth team. That'd be a far more positive contribution than an A-League senior men's team in terms of football development here in the ACT. But we don't have it. But what are we going to do about developing these under 17 to under 20 players who are now post-ACTAS, not in a youth league team? The Canberra United update. First home game against Sydney FC. We lost 2-1. Don't be disheartened by that. The game was very different in character to Queensland Roar. Sydney FC play a very physical game. They don't take any prisoners. They also play with some skill and determination, but it was very competitive, went right down to the wire, and probably unlucky not to sneak a draw in the last few minutes of the game. They play again this Saturday, and this time way across the other side of Australia in Perth. Just a reminder, it's a 10-round competition. We've lost two games, we haven't got a point, we're sitting on the bottom of the ladder. We need a win. We need to win pretty sharpish, which is a lot of pressure for the coach and the players. Perth might just be the place for it. Certainly hope so. All the best. You and me running, pouring from the rubbish dump, laughing. We carry treasures people threw away. Mum would shake her head and smile. My interview with John Mitchell began, as interviews often do, with a short discussion, and sometimes these discussions can become quite animated and of themselves very interesting. In this particular case, I'm going to start the interview this way. As we commenced, I made some statements about football, just as I saw it, very personal. John and I found ourselves in agreement. It was a pleasant way to start the interview. Straight from the off, John identified a problem that all innovators have in any sport, in any endeavour in life. Get yourself too far ahead of the pack and you become the target. People stop listening to the message, they begin to question your motives and your endeavours are blunted. It's exasperating. All we get out of blind, thick-headed opposition to good ideas is mediocrity. And football is not a mediocre game. It's a game of high emotion and high skill and talent. Our young talent, it should not be treated as being mediocre. I can't detect anything mediocre about John Mitchell. So here we go. You and me running, pouring from the rubbish dump, laughing. We carry treasures people threw away. Mum would shake her head and smile. I think what you've been saying is terrific, and I agree with virtually everything you've said so far about what's happening in football. Yes. ICT. Yeah, I meant what I said. I think that
those words are often better said by people other than me, because when I say things, what's happened in the past has polarised people, and so by virtue of saying them, sometimes they become negatives.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if people are actually all that considered or thoughtful, that it's much more personality-driven, opinionated, than it is about the facts of the matter.
Well, let's just keep rolling with this. That's a big problem in football, personalities. Cliques form in football, the mate system applies, they like you, the ideas get a run.
That's true. It's an intimate game. You're on the field with 10 other players. You're in a squad of 16 to 24 players who need to get along with a series of coaches. And tensions are fantastic in that they can produce, create things. But if they're too serious, then they tend to poison. And so you need this ongoing tension, but a bond that can still hold the group together.
Mm.
In the days where clubs and club mentality were primary, as it might still be in the AFL, it's no longer in football because of the introduction of money and the sale of players between clubs. Mm. People aren't wedded to their club, and so you've got to actually work. That's part of the job of a coach, to bring that group together, to bond that group. And sometimes even the best player doesn't fit in a group. I mean, Guardiola got rid of Eto'o from Barcelona.
He did,
despite
yeah.
the fact that he's a fine centre-forward, undoubtedly one of the world's best centre-forwards. Inter Milan wanted him, but for Guardiola it was not possible because it didn't work in the group.
Mm.
That's a group dynamic issue,
yeah.
which is why coaches need to be more than simply technical experts these days.
They do, don't they?
Mm.
We're talking to John Mitchell, coach of the ANU Premier League and their technical director. He's still a player too. He's been a sports administrator for a period of time. He was a technical director at Capital Football. He's an innovator, and I reference small-sided games in the ACT by way of that. He appears to look for solutions. I use the expression, someone who makes waves. Doesn't just get in the pool and splash and see where the water lands. Makes waves. And waves cause movement, and movement causes change, and with all of those things, some people are with it and some people are uncomfortable with it. That's life. John also appears to have a very specific interest in talented players, or should I say the development of players. It's just a fact that most coaches don't necessarily have that view. They might say they do, but the season often indicates that that's not the way they think.
Yeah.
Welcome, John.
Thank you. The development of players. My occupation, Peter, I'm a clinical psychologist and essentially a developmental theorist in that occupation. So development as a process, development structure of a person's emotional being is what I do for a living. So it was pretty easy for me in the world of football to look through those glasses, to look through a developmental glass, to understand that people aren't all of a sudden born as little adults with a unique set of abilities and talents and personality. They actually grow or wither, are delayed or are encouraged. And so it was quite easy for me to apply that mentality to the world of coaching in football.
The term talented player, it's such a vexatious subject. What is a talented player for you? At what age, what attribute, is there any template you have that you put over that?
My understanding of it is not dissimilar to many others, I believe. In the early years, we develop a physical dexterity. Early years, I mean 0 to 5.
Yep.
We either can track with our eyes balls that go rolling on the ground, or we struggle with that. Some kids are better at it than others by nature, and some kids are encouraged to do it more by their nurture situation, by dads rolling balls across floors and so on, or throwing the balls to catch, or encouraging them to go kick a ball. The thing that we know about young footballers, talented footballers, is all of them have touched the ball with their feet lots and lots and lots, thousands and thousands of occasions. The development of touch occurs in the very early years. I mean, we're talking from the tracking of a ball rolling across the floor at 0 to 1, all the way through to kicking the ball around the lounge room at 3, and continuing to kick on the field at 5. But it's the number of touches that develops what we call touch as the child grows.
It's as basic as that, isn't it?
I think it is, the number of touches, and again there's been study after study to support the idea that touch is the fundamental.
Mm.
Once you have a player that is touching the ball a sufficient number of times. And one of the reasons to support small-sided games is that players get more touches in game situations. To me, it's as obvious as that. You want each player on the field to have as many touches as possible. The more players have the more touches, the more chance you have of developing whatever natural abilities they have. And again, some kids are better at coordination and agility and have greater physical capacity, but if they all have a sufficient level of touch of the football, then they have an equal opportunity to develop those talents. Now, as they grow a little older, what you end up with is a child who now has touch and is having a series of touches in a game situation, and that the touches are controlling touches, organising touches, agile touches, movement around the ball. What needs to occur for a talented player is the development at that point of specific technique growing out of touch, the ability to pass the football with both feet, the capacity to maintain balance when you're doing so. Probably the primary ability, from my mind, is the ability to run with the football. Can you run with the ball at your feet without losing control of the ball?
Yeah.
Can you move the ball with each touch of the football? Can you move the ball to a space that it is still in your control and you're moving with it? So it essentially stays between your feet, essentially. This leads into the skill set that I have been associated with, which was developed by Ron Smith at the AIS when he was head coach there, which talks about some basic habits. And the development of basic habits is associated with the development of a talented footballer. So you have touch, growing on that, the number of touches in a game situation, the application of touch within a game situation, and then into the development of what's called a habit set or a skill set.
Oh, yes.
And that habit set is quite unique, developed by Ron in his understanding simply by watching the finest players in the world. And if you watch the finest players around the world, by and large, they play with the ball between their feet. By and large, they move the ball with their first touch. We teach kids at the age of six, the most usual scenario is having two kids standing opposite each other, passing the ball directly to each other and stopping it and then passing it back. This never happens in a game of football. We discourage as much as we can straight passes. We like angled passes, and yet we teach kids to do straight passes. We encourage players to, another one of the skills set, move the ball with the first touch. And yet we teach kids from the beginning to stop the ball. And very rarely, unless you're Ronaldinho, who stops the ball, I'll bet you if you watch Lionel Messi play, you'll hardly see him stop a ball at all. Everything moves at all times.
You control the ball, but he won't stop the ball.
He won't stop it. He'll keep moving it to another space because he's moving it away from feet, away from defenders' feet, away into space, because the game is a mobile and dynamic game. So for me, developing that skill set at the earliest possible age is the key to talent development.
And what would be that age?
As soon as they have sufficient touch. We tried at the age of 10 and 11 with some young boys at the Woden Valley Club. We asked Ron to come along. Luckily enough, before he became technical director at FFA, Ron had a few months spare, and we asked him to come along and coach these under, I think they're under 11s. Boys, and did so for a few months, and we learned the skill set while we were watching him. At that age, they took to it like ducks to water.
Yeah, I'd expect that.
And it was amazing to watch. I can tell you now that from that group that started those years ago, we've had four from that group alone who have got AIS scholarships.
Is that right?
From one club and one group working on that basic skill set at the age of 11.
So they got inoculated with that at that age, and it took.
So it sounds to me like the right age.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is teaching a basic skill set. Could it be taught earlier? Maybe, possibly. I don't see why not. Once the child has an awareness of what's going on the field, what are we trying to achieve, and can organise themselves into, small-sided games encourages the organisation of small triangles and diamond shapes, why not? Why not? Why not from the very start encourage kids to move the ball with their first touch rather than to trap it? Why not encourage keeping the ball between your feet as much as possible. Why not encourage scanning behind you before you receive the ball? Continually scanning, both after you've passed the ball and before you receive the ball.
Yeah, I would have thought those years, just from my own limited experience as a local coach, 9, 10, 11 and 12 are terrific years to be delivering this sort of training.
Absolutely.
They're completely ready for it.
Absolutely.
Love every bit of it. When more touches, the better.
More touches and giving specific specific instruction. Colin Johnston at Woad has got a marvellous system at the moment.
He does, yes.
Where he has adopted this skill set and used it at an age-appropriate level to develop the players. And it means introducing what we understand to be associated with talented play at the earliest possible age, such that they can continue to practice and it becomes routine. It's not something you've got to learn at the age of 16. Oh, I should look behind me in case. We've got some players from other clubs at the moment, just to digress. We're going to play some National Youth League bye games over the next few months. And some of the players that have come from other clubs are still struggling with this basic skill set.
Yeah.
Where we've got to go through a conscious intent now to say, can you look behind you before the ball arrives at you?
You're listening to the Near Post Local, 2XXFM, and we're talking to John Mitchell, coach of ANU Premier League. We're speaking about the development of the talented footballer.
Put that another way, if you were to feed these young players this diet, it would be a rich diet in football terms. You're establishing some very serious preferential behaviour when they play.
Absolutely.
So under pressure, that's what they'll go to.
Yes, absolutely. As opposed to what happens at the moment under pressure is we revert to form, and our form tends to be, let's boot the hell out of it. Let's play it as long as possible out of there. Which, I mean, there are points where you've got to do that in a football match, but by and large, is it possible
to play that way?
Yeah. Is it possible for us to learn to play a passing style, a possession style of game, short passing, gathering around each other, taking up positions of both support and forward running? Now, if we can start that at those ages, then we have a whole talent pool now where we can select. And in the end, of course, you asked the initial question about talented player. In the end, the players that succeed, whether this is right or wrong, are the ones that are most physically capable.
Yes, it really sharpens the pencil, doesn't it? Oh. If they've got that, then different set of discriminators later.
Real Madrid have recently done a study. There's a lovely piece of research out on the genetics of power. Football is now understood very much. Formerly it was as a speed game or as an endurance game, but now is very much understood as a power game. The ability to move with power over a very short distance, 1 metre, typically diagonally. Now, Real Madrid undertook this study with a local researcher and found the vast majority of the players in their first team squad had power genes inherited from both mother and father.
Is that right?
So we're now at a position where the science is telling us, while you can be incredibly talented, have great touch, have good technique, have a super skill set, you know, move the ball with first touch, scan constantly, keep the ball between your feet, they're a marvellous skill set to operate from. In the end, genetics are going to play this overwhelming part to those that will go on to professional status.
Yes.
Ron did a little study of characters that left the AIS and were successful in getting overseas contracts. I should say that the AIS is the most successful that in the world, football academy, or was, in the number of successful graduates in terms of getting professional contracts.
I didn't know that.
But he did a little study, and guess what? The ones that got the contracts were, by and large, the fastest, the most powerful, the most capable of endurance work. You know, they were getting 14 plus on the beep, they were getting sub 3 seconds on the 20 metre run, and while they are rudimentary measures of football physical ability, and we've got better measures now, it just shows. If you can jump 60 centimetres on a vertical leap, and you have all those other things we've already spoken about, you have the potential to play.
Yeah, you're well positioned, aren't you? Cliche, but coaches also good engine.
Well, that's the VO2 part there, the endurance part. You've got to be able to have good engines. However, Josip Simenic, who's been spoken about many times, had a real struggle. He was a central midfielder when he was working with Ron at the AIS, perhaps the most talented player ever to go through the AIS. In terms of technique and touch.
Yeah, I've heard that said, actually. Yeah.
And he plays centre-back for Croatia. He plays centre-back because he doesn't have good engines. He's fast, and he's obviously rather big, and he has incredible technique and skill, which allows him to be quite a calm and dominating centre-back. But he's not got sufficient engines to play in the midfield. So that's a positional thing as well. You know,
yes.
There are people with different physical sets and where they play on the field. You know, you'll find goalkeepers with huge vertical leaps. For example, you don't have to be as a central midfielder, you don't have to have such a power base. Endurance is much more important in that endeavour. Although, it's still important.
Yeah.
So it's more of a balancing act than it is about either or.
This is a very interesting take on this. I think you described it in a very informative way. We just step forward out of this and say, if we try and bring this down to, say, our club level, how do clubs deal with this? Where's their approach to this? Level of expertise in clubs is pretty variable.
That's a hard question in Australia. The difficulty in Australia is in the capacity to understand this developmental process. I already mentioned Colin. I think that the Wogan program offers something unique, as far as I can see, around the country. The local league, I think we've got to come to understand that you're not going to find players that are of a professional capability in our local leagues, perhaps as youth players. I should be cautious about saying that because in my opinion there are two or three players in the local league who could quite easily fit into an A-League format and be professional players. They choose to live in Canberra and so they're not. But by and large, the local leagues aren't going to have this sort of talented player. That doesn't stop us from trying to play the best sort of football because it's more fun. It's more fun to have more touches on the ball. It's more fun to be able to dribble the ball past opponents. It's more fun to be able to score spectacular goals. I don't think it's as much fun to be able to roost the ball down the other end of the field, pick up some scraps and score and win the game. While we all enjoy winning, I'd much rather do it in an attractive and interesting manner. I think it creates more fun to play. I think it is more entertaining to play and may actually bring some crowds to the game if it was an entertaining thing.
Keep kids in the game too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because they're involved.
Yep.
Rather than, you know, I'm just making up
big
the numbers
issue,
here. You know? So, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to pursue irrespective of whether we identify this person as a talented player or an elite player. Having said that, there are some youth players in the ACT. We have a unique situation here. I mean, many of us have lived in Sydney, so we understand the size of Sydney. You simply can't expect people to come to training every night of the week in Sydney. Because if training's at Valentine Park and you live in Cronulla, that's a couple of hours.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
And there isn't enough money to have multiple forms of this. They only have the one team at the moment. They're about to have a second A-League team developing at that elite level, which means Canberra has this fantastic opportunity for the half dozen very talented players. We can actually get them together and train at Hawker or train at the university or wherever and give them this opportunity to actually take the next step, which is why it was not unusual. It wasn't surprising at all that for me in the representative group I was fortunate enough to coach produced, we now have six players that have been through the AIS program from that 1 year.
What representative group was that, John?
They're the 92 borns.
Ah.
The 92 borns have, four have full-time scholarships, two others have played for the Joeys, the Qantas Joey, and another two, so that's eight, another two have had short-term contracts at the AIS.
Yeah.
Most of them went into ACTAS.
And
in fact, I think all of them went through ACTAS. But yes, with the Capital Football Group, I had the 92s, and then they moved on to Milo at ACTAS.
Yeah. And of course, the point you're making also, I think, is that when you say we ought to be doing this, there's absolutely nothing stopping all clubs from picking up that approach. Clearly, the better training that goes on at the distributed levels at club, the likelihood is that we might see a few more of those talented players emerge, really talented players.
Oh, yeah. And that's why we need to focus on the developmental process, the youth process, and get clubs to emulate what they're doing over at Woden, to develop a system of good football, what we encourage in our play, a skill set that is understood by each of the coaching staff, the encouragement to have as many touches on the ball, the recognition of the various habits. It's not. I don't think it's that complicated. I mean, I think we as youth coaches often overcomplicate things. We try and talk about systems of play. And, you know, this, we must all now play 4-3-3. You know, rather than.
How do you feel about that? We want to come onto the curriculum shortly, but how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think it's a curriculum issue. Well, if you go
and
compared to say an educational context, that would be a little like saying you will have one teacher for every 10 students. It's not a bad thing. I don't think that God dictated it and this is right and we should always have it, because sometimes one teacher for 12 students is a good idea and sometimes one teacher for 5 students is a good idea. Structures in football are like that. You know, it depends on who you're playing against, it depends on what you're trying to do. Mentioned earlier on, the key is about shape, and the shapes that do well in football are diagonals. Diagonals make up triangles or diamond shapes. Whatever system you play needs to encourage those rather than straight line play. And what you're trying to do in a given situation, a given game, is to compete with a team that is playing a certain shape. What shape can you play that's going to be competitive against that team to encourage your triangular play but to stop them? The idea that one size fits all, I think, is kind of odd. I mean, it's not a bad structure. We, at the moment, are using a 4-3-3 structure commonly, but this season we defended it as a 4-5-1. We attacked as a 4-3-3. We had played a 4-4-2 at some point during the season. I noticed that the most successful team this year ostensibly looked like a 4-4-2, but was probably more like a 4-6-1, and that was Canberra FC.
I'll go along with that.
Huge numbers in midfield. And dominated the game, and each of them with the capacity to make forward runs. So, you know, for most of the game, if you'd drawn the structure, it looked more like a 3-6-1, which was kind of interesting. The other most successful team of Belconnen clearly played as a 3-5-2 all year. Now, they're the most successful teams in the ACT. Why they didn't play 4-3-3, I don't see that. It's a super thing to do. I think one of the other parts that we kind of recognise, the ANU, is that the only time that structures like that really matter on a football field, because of the nature of transition in football, the only time it really matters is in the final third when you're defending. So when the other team has the ball, you've just lost it, and you're trying to press high to win the ball back in the final third, who picks up whom at that point? That, to me, is probably the only time where structures make a lot of sense. Because otherwise, at any other time in the football game, when you're defending in the back third, and if you stopped play immediately and drew where the players were on a map, you would often see you'd have six defenders and you might be playing with a 6-3-1 at that moment.
At that moment.
Because
everyone's getting back to repel borders.
Because you're trying to stop the other team scoring and they've got six attackers. You need to actually defend effectively against those six attackers. You can't go, well, they've got six forwards, but we've only got four defenders, so we'll just stay in the midfield. Yeah. So structures, to me, a lot of nonsense goes on. Coaches talk on and on about structures, but they're really most important in that final third.
Yeah, they are. And the pretty parade ground formations just look good if you were to take a snapshot, but they don't actually do much for you after that. They dumb down football.
Well,
dangerously so, I think.
Absolutely, but I don't know if any of the serious teams actually get hooked into them. I mean, I think television commentators get hooked into them because they kind of like to discuss those things and who's playing where and is he playing as a 10 or is he more as a 5 and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and when they can't explain it, they usually say, I think the coach has given him licence.
Yeah.
John, if we could just linger on small-sided games just for a little bit more. We've talked about 10, 11 and 12 and how those changes have advantaged the development of the numbers of touches they get, the sort of things we were talking about. The new national curriculum is now going to require us here in the ACT and everywhere in Australia to have the under-12s move to a full-size field 11v11. Is there some advantage to this that's certainly not apparent to me?
No.
No.
No, no. I think it's what you were saying when we had a break. I think it is a retrograde step. Even if you could make a case that the bigger under-12s could cope with a full-size field and play effectively without getting strung out by staying in close proximity with each other and forming good shapes to play together, even if you could sustain that with the best players, there is no doubt in my head that you can't sustain that for any other group. So as a rule, it's nonsense.
Yeah.
To do it across the entire group. Perhaps you could say this is a worthwhile activity every now and then to try, and it may very well be a worthwhile activity every now and then to try. There's this rule of thumb that says a field should be as long as the average player can kick the ball twice on the full.
Okay.
I would like to see that sort of guide applied, because I don't know many under 12s that could kick to halfway on a full-size field.
Nor do I.
One of the things that I thought we should have started to look at when I was at Capital Football was the size of field for Masters competition.
Because
you know, as you get old, as I'm old, you simply can't kick the ball as far. I mean, I certainly used to be able to kick it over halfway, but I can't do that anymore. You know, when you're 50 or so, that's just not possible. Now, it might be for others, not for me. So I'm thinking to myself, why would I go out and play at Masters and run myself silly and be completely knackered within about 30 minutes, where maybe if I played on a, I don't know, I haven't even measured it, but maybe it's a 60 or 70 metre field, maybe I'd have a lot more fun, wouldn't be quite so stuffed, and would actually make it through the time of the game.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because often if I go for a walk early Sunday, I'll wander down to Mawson Playing Fields, and down near the old canteen area, there's a bunch of blokes my age who get out and play football.
Yeah, I've seen them there.
Yeah, and guess what they're doing? They're playing on a small-sided game.
Yeah, when you've got a matter of choice.
Yeah, that's where you go.
You don't go and play a full side, because it's just kind of silly.
Yeah.
So you start to ask the question across all the areas of football, whether we're talking about old men or whether we're talking about Division Two boys or whether we're talking about women, should we not start thinking more clearly about what's appropriate? What's the best fit, instead of having some sort of competitive idea that I need to be on the biggest field, that'll show that I'm a really great player? Yeah. And it does seem to me to be a lot like a your standard male contest, I think.
Yeah. I'm with you there. John Mitchell, thank you very much for your time. You've been most generous. Wish you all the best with the forthcoming season. This is a thought-provoking and very, very positive contribution to football in the ACT.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, that's it for the Near Post Local this week. If you're getting to the Near Post, get there first. Absolutely no point in getting there second. The goalkeeper will probably have the ball. Enjoy your football and your futsal. All the best to Canberra United. Hope they get their first win. See you next week, and definitely make sure you get there first. All I do is close my eyes. My mind takes me back. Today's eventless summers. Stormy winter ocean. We've come a long way since then. Memories never change. They get a little faded. Again.